Hello and welcome to this week's TES podcast. I'm Dave Speck and joining me is the usual editorial team. We've got reporter John Roberts. John, hi.
Hello there.
Got reporter Catherine Luff. Hi, Catherine.
Hello.
Got reporter Amy Gibbons. Amy, hello.
Hello.
And we've got news editor Will Stewart. Will, hi.
Hello.
Now, news this week is that the Public Service Union, Unison, has hatched a plan to save Christmas. And part of the plan is that schools should move online, completely online, by December the 10th. And that would help to keep the infection rate down so that families can definitely spend Christmas together. John, can I start with you? That's not likely to happen, is it, given the letter that we've seen from Gavin Williamson and Matt Hancock today?
It would certainly mark a major change in direction, wouldn't it, from everything we've seen from the government? And yeah, the story we wrote this morning was that, as you say, Gavin Williamson and Matt Hancock have written to public health directors around the country, basically kind of instructing them to hold the line and stick to the DfE's position, which is that schools are staying open during the national lockdown, and that this framework that the government created, this four-tier system for schools, is not to be used or not to be used yet, even though we are in a national lockdown. And the context to that, I think, is that you're obviously seeing COVID impacting very differently in different parts of the country. And we've both been doing some pieces about Hull, which is kind of at the very sharp end of this. And yeah, we've also seen a letter from the DfE to Hull head teachers where essentially Hull heads asked for the kind of leeway for them to be able to move to rotas or close year groups as they saw fit because the impact's so bad. And the DfE, the letter from the regional schools commissioner, basically said, no, that would be a national decision based on SAGE. It's not something to be done locally. And again, referred back to this letter. So it seems even now, the DfE is sticking to this line that certainly, I mean, I suppose the lockdown is finite and we'll see what happens after that. But yeah, certainly in the lockdown, schools staying open, even when heads across the city are saying we're a breaking point or we're struggling, we're straining.
If they're gonna stay open during the lockdown, then that's it, isn't it? They're gonna stay open. And yeah, I mean, if you don't close them when things are at the peak,
I suppose I'm a pessimist and think that the lockdown doesn't end at the beginning of December. Do you know what I mean? I know they said it'll finish, but I can't imagine we're just gonna return to some kind of normality.
Can I ask you? I know you've done another story today. What are the what are the attendance rates in schools in Hull at the moment?
Yeah, so the latest figures that we've had, like a kind of a situation report we've had sight of, shows that the attendance rate 2 days ago was 65% of pupils in, something around just over one in six teachers off, and numbers as well specifically COVID related. So this is either people who've tested positive, have symptoms, or are self isolating as part of a bubble closing down. 8,000 pupils, more than 8,000 pupils off, and more than 300 teachers off. So in a sense, they're already on a kind of an ad hoc, kind of chaotic rota. It's just not one that's been done by design, but is enforced because people are having to be off because of COVID. And I think that's part of the point they're making. Do you know what I mean? It's actual, we're not fully open now anyway. It's impossible to be. So why not give us the latitude, to use their words, to kind of manage it? I was really struck by one thing a Hull head teacher said to us, which was that he said he felt to them that the DfE, or politicians in London, to use his, Northern axe to grind, politicians in London are more interested in being able to say schools are fully open than they are in helping schools on the ground in the hardest hit areas think about what's best in terms of education. And I think that's something that's resonated a lot on social media this morning as well.
And that point seems to be that... Sorry.
No, I was just going to say... When we're on Zoom, we can't see it. Will, you go, please. Will, you go.
Sorry. I was going to say that. I forgot my point now. Their point seems to be that by allowing rotas, it would actually allow schools to open. The ministers would get what they wanted. That was the only way to do it. So that was worth the wait, wasn't it? Sorry, Dave.
Talk about, we've got a real sort of good insight into the situation inside Hull schools right now. We've spoken to a couple of teachers in vulnerable age groups, and one of them is actually in a vulnerable health group. They're in secondary schools in Hull.
This is your interview, isn't it, Dave? You've been speaking to these
teachers. That's right. Yeah, I mean, they both wanted to be anonymous, but I mean, a couple of things that struck me. One of they both said the bubble system is a nonsense, and one said that you've got different year group bubbles sharing the same toilets, sharing the same stairwells, and then if a pupil does test positive, only the pupils around them in the class are being sent home rather than the whole bubble, which apparently was the idea, wasn't it? But and then you've got behaviour as well. It's just taking a huge nosedive, apparently, because they're having to rely on so many supply teachers, so that pupils haven't got continuity, and the work is just an infill, was the word that this teacher used. And kids can see through that. Any teacher will tell you that, you know, after a few weeks of supply teaching with just sort of filling work, the kids get fed up and they start to misbehave and go off the rails, and that's what's happening, apparently.
Some of the language they were using as well. I mean, obviously, it just shines through what a kind of, you know, it's important to hear about the heads and the case they're making. But I thought your piece was, Dave, was such a good accompaniment to it, because it really shows what teachers on the ground, you know, you can't even lobby ministers about this, and they literally feel like they're risking their lives, don't they? They're that frightened. I mean, it, you know, never mind, well, I'm sure they are to some extent, but it's like, even if they weren't, they certainly feel like they are, that they're putting their lives on the line. It's quite powerful stuff. I would read it.
But I think, Amy, your story from Monday shed light on the fact that actual COVID rates in schools could be far higher than we thought last week at this time. Would that be fair?
Yeah, absolutely. Yes, we did a bit of analysis on Monday off the back of the investigation that John and I did at the end of last week, in which we found that at least one in three schools have had staff or pupils test positive for COVID-19 since the start of term. But we thought it was slightly telling, actually, that the first reaction of lots of teachers when we revealed the results back on Friday last week was to warn that the figures the councils provided to us were actually not necessarily telling the whole story. So there was one person who said, who raised questions that it may be an underestimation of the extent of the virus in education, but not necessarily just down to the local authorities themselves. It might be because actually schools are not necessarily, or not all schools are necessarily reporting the cases in the first place. So it might be an issue with the reporting at school's end rather than, you know, what the councils had told us. But there was also some issue with certain COVID hotspots or known COVID hotspots, like places in Merseyside, for example, missing from the data. And this is because, you know, we went to all the councils and not all of the councils came back to us, which is often the way. But unfortunately, there were some that, you know, we specifically asked for the figures and either they chose not to respond at all, or we just never heard back from them, or they said that, you know, we had to obtain the figures from, you know, in a different way, for example, from the DfE. So for that reason, some people thought that actually the situation might be worse even than we thought, even though, you know, the figure that we gave was in itself quite shocking. And therefore, that's worth considering and wondering whether in those areas, places like Liverpool, Sefton, Knowsley, those places that have been hit really badly and were actually in tier three before the new lockdown, whether the cases in their schools might be even higher proportions than we'd seen on average. So it's an interesting exercise, yeah, just to look at some of those.
I know that the DfE are releasing weekly attendance figures for pupils, and they're releasing figures for the number of suspected and confirmed COVID cases among pupils. But interestingly, yesterday, Naswert called for the figures for teacher COVID rates to be released each week, number of teachers who are infected, which seems to be a fairly important figure fairly important data that we need to know that's not available right now.
What was the government's response to that, Dave?
Yeah, I mean, the DfE said that, again, they've repeated that staff in schools are not at higher risk than workers in other sectors. And they also say that they've already strengthened measures to reduce transmission in schools, including requiring face coverings in all secondary schools in communal areas outside classrooms. That was something else that they mentioned.
What strikes me about that is if the DfE wants to make that case, publish the figures. Do you know what I mean? Like, if I'm a teacher, I'm not reassured by words that sound like what they said in September. show us the data. That's what would reassure me. Or not. Do you know what I mean? Depending on what the data tells you. It feel like it's bizarre that schools are at the forefront of not being in the lockdown, and yet this data is not available. I think it's, you can imagine teachers tearing their hair out about it.
I think it's just become such a, I mean, sorry, coming back on to your story, John, they were so clear, weren't they, that in that letter from Matt Hancock and Gavin Williamson, that they would not move through to these tier systems. So it's like, they've just nailed the colours to the mast, haven't they? Schools will remain open no matter what. And I guess that's probably why they don't want to publish any teacher data, because it would...
Yeah, risks undermining that. I think, again, we've probably talked about this before, but it's one thing, and I think a lot of people support the decision, like the teaching unions and political parties, to keep schools open in the lockdown. That's, you know, that's the kind of a national priority. But it's another thing to kind of, it feels like in a way, reading these letters that we've had, that's our line, so schools are kind of exempt from it. But it doesn't mean, shouldn't give them a kind of a carte blanche not to look at schools at all. You'd think there'd be more about how can we manage schools, how can we support schools to say stay open given that they are a priority, how can we support teachers to feel reassured given that they're a priority. And it feels a little bit like they're just kind of clinging to September's soundbites almost, that they just, this is what we said at the start of the year and we don't want to give that up.
Well, it was a line that kind of worked better. Well, not a line, it was a position that I think made more sense at the start of the year when there didn't seem to be as much evidence about how much COVID there was in schools. And it was, you know, it was kind of, it's not an issue in primary schools, which seems to be the answer, but the jury's out on secondary schools. And I think the figures that we're seeing in Hull as being, you know, the most extreme example suggest that might not be right anymore.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, one thing we haven't mentioned yet today is GCSEs, which would be a great loss if we had a podcast without mentioning that. And Catherine, we've had a chat with Colin Hughes, haven't we? He was the chief executive of the AQA. Did we have a chat with him, or did he write a piece for us?
No, I had a chat with him, but yeah, it was. I think sort of lots of we could have went through what some of the plans might be for GCSEs and A levels next year, and sort of some of. I think essentially, you know, what he said was that there's no kind of one size fits all solution to the problem that's going to solve all the injustices that have been created or exacerbated by COVID. But I think, you know, it was really interesting to see what his view was of some of the different options.
Yeah, what options did he listed the options, didn't he? What did he talk about?
So there were a few. So I think you know, one was sort of, for example, holding kind of mock exams in the spring, which one thing he said about that was that if you were going to do that, then you would couldn't probably have a set of reserve papers after the summer series, because then the boards would effectively be running three sets of exams. And then sort of, you know, in terms of some of the other things mentioned, you know, having a post-summer reserve papers, also sort of consolidating exams into a single paper, so that and giving grades based on one paper, possibly using like a form of special consideration by region, depending on which areas of the country have been most hard hit by the pandemic. And then he also referenced optionality, which was first discussed by Dame Glenys Stacey as well as sort of the idea that students would be able to choose questions in papers based on what topics they'd studied.
Yeah. I mean, it's probably worth pointing out that he wasn't endorsing these. I mean, you can read the piece and you can see what he thought of each one of those. But I mean, for example. You know, regional grading, he certainly didn't think that would be a good idea, although obviously that's something that Labour want to see. I think that was your story, wasn't it, Dave?
Yeah. But, I mean, your piece today, Will, you say it seems it's a breath of fresh air, this admission from somebody so key in the sector that there is no complete solution, that exams are not the answer.
Yeah, I just thought it did stand out for me. The interview from Colin Hughes, mainly because I think he was prepared to be so open about the fact that there is no obvious solution, but also because he's prepared to kind of go on the record and put his name to it. I mean, I for me, a lot of what some people have said that what happened this year was never going to work. But for me, I thought a lot of it was a communications problem, that what came out, I'm not saying it was the only problem, but a big problem was that what came out, on the day and nobody really expected it. And Ofqual knew there were kind of issues with unfairnesses that, you know, papers have shown up since they were aware of, but they chose not to kind of talk them through. And I think that's a lesson from last year. There isn't any one thing that's going to work. There is no easy way out. So the only thing to do then is put it all out there and make it as public as possible and let people make their contributions, so that when it comes to the end, everybody knew, well, you know, they knew where it was coming from. They knew this is what we're going to end up with. We've had the debate. There's no, and I think that's the only way you'll get something at the end of all this that keeps, you're not going to make everybody happy, but at least keeps enough people happy to be able to make it stick. And I just really worry that what's happening this time feels like a bit of a repeat of what happened last year. I mean, we'll see. You know, Ofqual have promised that they're going to come out with something soon, but it's been more than a month, I think, since they said that. So, you know, for me, full marks to Colin Hughes for being more open. I hope everybody else is, because otherwise, I can't see it going in a good direction.
Yeah. Well, look, let's wrap it up. And one of the heroes of the coronavirus pandemic is Marcus Rashford, undoubtedly. Amy, what's he been up to this week?
There was a really good feel-good story this week when we found out that Marcus Rashford would be setting up his own book club. The aim was to help all children, and regardless of where they come from, so regardless of their background, experience the feeling of escapism that you get through reading, which I thought was a really nice idea. He talked about how important reading was to him and how it's kind of allowed him to experience that feeling and how much he appreciated that. But also how, as a child, obviously he's spoken before about how he was on free school meals and things were really tough for his family, and often food had to be prioritised over things like books and reading. So he wants to make sure that all young people and children from everywhere can experience it. So we thought it'd be a nice idea if we asked some English teachers to recommend some books that they thought would be good for Rashford to feature in his club, in his reading club. We had some really lovely suggestions, some that will be really familiar to people obviously working in schools. So I remember studying Holes by Louisa Carr, and that was a great book. So that was one of the ones that came up. We also had the classic Wind in the Willows, which lots of people will be familiar with, but also one that really far more modern, I think, and also one that Marcus Rashford had recommended himself. There's a book called Unstoppable by Dan Friedman. So Marcus Rashford had said fairly recently, you should definitely check this out. This is a brilliant book. So it was great to be able to have an English teacher suggest that to include on the list, to really reflect the kind of stuff that Rashford thinks would be good to get children reading. So it was a fun one to do. We also had Noughts and Crosses, Mallory Blackman, that's a really popular one, some Anne Fine and some Roald Dahl as well. So do check out the list, because there's some great ideas on there, and it's just a nice kind of feel-good story showing that Rashford is still kind of pushing ahead, trying to make a difference for children who are perhaps not as fortunate as others. It's a nice story.
And it's number 3 in the Tezza's top 10 today.
Yeah, lots of people reading, wanting to find out which books made it, yeah.
Yeah. Well, look, thanks for listening, and we'll see you all soon. Bye.
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 Bye.